Welcome to the 12th Annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. I am Gene Meyer, President of the Federalist Society. This memorial lecture series started, as many of you know, with Ted Olson's inaugural lecture, which reminded us of what it means to be an American and how our legal tradition is a critical part of our identity as Americans. Both Ted and Barbara understood this connection. We want the lecture series to remind lawyers of it so that they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. And I would add that we were very pleased to have Ted Olson with us today. I know he was going to have to be out of town, and I'm pleased he was able to make it back in time. So. Ted's inaugural lecture was followed by Ken Starr, Robert Bork, Justice Scalia, Judge Randolph, Vice President Cheney, and Chief Justice Roberts, and Judges Edith Jones, Douglas Ginsburg, and Dennis Jacobs, and former Attorney General Michael Mukasey. That brings us to today's lecture. Peter Thiel is a technology entrepreneur, investor, and philanthropist. He first gained attention for innovations in banking and startup finance. He was the founder of PayPal. He was the first outside investor in Facebook, where he still serves on the board. He's repeatedly warned of a coming technology deficit, which with severe economic consequences. And he's warned me that there may be some slight degree of concern involved in his lecture today. He works to accelerate innovation to prevent such a crisis. And he does this by identifying and funding promising technology ideas and by helping to guide successful companies to dominate their industries. In 2004, he co-founded Palantir Technologies, which offers platforms for finance companies and intelligence, defense, and law enforcement communities to integrate, visualize, and analyze the world's information. And given who this lecture is named after, it seems appropriate to note that Palantir software helped track down Bin Laden. Building on his personal success as a venture capital investor, Peter co-founded and manages Founders Fund, a leading Silicon Valley venture capital fund that has pioneered new methods of venture financing that benefit founders. Through the Founders Fund, as well as through his private investing, he's helped launch the next generation of tech companies, such as SpaceX, LinkedIn, Yelp, Robotech, Spotify, Practice Fusion, and ZocDoc. And he has an astonishing array of interests. He established and funds the Thiel Foundation, which promotes freedom in all its forms. He's supported everything from efforts to protect journalists, to the Seasteading Institute, to artificial intelligence research, to longevity research. And I've skipped many other things. He famously created the 20 Under 20 Thiel Fellowship, which nurtures the tech visionaries of tomorrow. And he formed breakout labs to help independent scientists, engineers, and inventors advance their most radical ideas. He earned a BA in philosophy from Stanford University and a JD from Stanford Law School, where he occasionally teaches on globalization and technology. And I would add he was the president of the Federal Society chapter at Stanford when he was there. His articles have appeared in Policy Review and the Wall Street Journal. He co-produced the film Thank You for Smoking. And I can assure you he can beat any of you in this room at chess. It is my honor to introduce, for this year's Barbara Olson Lecture, Peter Thiel.
Well, Gene, I actually don't think I could beat you in chess, but thank you very much for that incredibly gracious introduction. I'm extremely privileged to be here tonight to speak to you about where I see this country and our world going in some ways, and I think it's worth reflecting on how we're all in a sort of extremely privileged context, not just in our professions, in law and other, you know, related fields, not only because we're U.S. citizens, but also if you think of it sort of in the much broader sweep of history, you know, there probably have been something like 100 billion people who have lived in the history of the world. About 7 billion of them are alive today. And it is, I think, always a very sobering fact to reflect on that that most of them lived in societies that were fundamentally static, incredibly poor, and unchanging. And things did not change from one generation to the next. And I think Western civilization has been exceptional because it has been one in which there has been, you know, in the most, looking at it from the most narrow economic perspective, there has been broad prosperity, and it has been a period of ever-increasing prosperity, at least since the mid-18th century. You can perhaps date it to before then. We've been living in this accelerating technological civilization for 200, 250 years. It's one that's enabled a broad middle class to exist, and it's one in which the expectation has been that things get better from one generation to the next. And I would estimate that maybe of the 100 billion people in the history of the world, maybe 3 billion have lived in this period, in this sort of accelerating technological civilization. And I do think that we often underestimate how important science and technology have been as fundamental drivers. I think that as long as there is robust progress in science and technology, to speak of the decline of the West is perhaps premature. But the question we need to also ask is whether the story of accelerating progress still remains true or not. And in recent years, I've become convinced that there are, you know, a lot more problems with it than is generally advertised. And you can look at any of a number of different domains. I want to give sort of a quick overview of some of them, and then try to talk a little bit about how to think about our current context. If you look at the last 30 or 40 years, I would argue that we have had tremendous progress in computers and the internet and almost nowhere else. If you sort of look at any of a number of domains, things have not been accelerating. We can start with the most literal, which is that we are not moving faster. People moved faster, you know, every decade from 1600 onwards. You had faster sailing boats. In the 19th century, you had ever faster railroads, then faster cars, faster airplanes, culminated with the Concorde in 1976. It was decommissioned in 2003. And if you now include very low-tech airport security systems, we're back to travel speeds of circa 1960. Then when one sort of broadens this transportation slowdown, you also see that there's been a slowdown in progress on the energy and a variety of commodity types of areas where in the most fundamental sense we have not recovered from the oil shock of 1973. After inflation, even including inflation, oil prices are significantly above where they were in 1973. And this sort of general oil crisis has broadened into a, you know, commodity crisis more generally in many different areas that one looks at over the last decade. There was this very famous bet between Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich in the 1980s, which was a bet about this, and Simon famously won the bet in 1990. But if you had rerun the bet on a rolling decade basis, Ehrlich's been winning the bet every decade since 1993. He won it from 93 to 2003, 94 to 04, and in the last decade, sort of by a margin that more or less offset the progress of the last 100 years. If you look at one of the smartest investors in the world is considered to be Warren Buffett. His biggest single investment is investing in the railroad industry, which is, I think, sort of a bet against technological progress, both in transportation and energy. Most of what gets transported on railroads is coal, and Buffett is essentially betting that the 21st century will look more like the 19th than the 20th. We'll go back to rail and back to coal, because we're going to run out of oil and clean tech is going to fail. And I think when one looks at agriculture, something like the Green Revolution in the Middle East, often gets spun as this story of extremely optimistic technological change, where Twitter and the information revolution somehow liberated the world. But I think there's also a pessimistic technological story that needs to be said, that the so-called Green Revolution really was symptomatic of the failure of the true Green Revolution, which was in agriculture in the 1950s and 60s, and led to dramatically increased crop yields around the world. Agricultural yields have not gone up that much in the last 25 or 30 years, and so I think that a big part of the story of what happened in the Arab Spring needs to be understood as desperate people who had become more hungry than scared, and it was sort of a story of technological failure once again. In medicine, biotechnology, there still is sort of a tailwind. Life expectancy continues to go up by about 2.5 years per decade. It's been sort of a straight line since about 1840, 1850. But there are sort of signs of deceleration. At this point, there are only about one-third as many drugs being approved each year by the FDA as there were 20 years ago. And I think people's optimism about the future has started to seep out of the system. And we see this, I think, in all these areas, that we've seen less progress for 40 years, and people are starting to expect less progress. When Nixon declared war on cancer in 1970 and said we would defeat cancer in 1976 by the bicentennial, today, 42 years later, we are, by definition, 42 years closer to the goal. But most people think we're further than 6 years away. And it would be almost inconceivable to, say, start a comparable war on Alzheimer's, even though something like 40% of the people who get to age 85 suffer from some form of dementia. And so so you have sort of this deceleration along with massively reduced expectations. I think the one extraordinary exception to this is the computer revolution, and it has certainly resulted in a certain amount of progress in the last 40 years. It's what I work in and what I invest in. But nevertheless, as a concerned citizen, I have to wonder whether it's actually enough to really propel an entire society forwards. If you look at the state of things, if you said computer revolution is centered in the state of California and Silicon Valley, you might infer that given the breathtaking accounts of how fantastic it is, that California must therefore be the most prosperous and successful state in the US. And Silicon Valley is about 2 congressional districts, and there are something like 50 others where it's not really clear what people are doing. And this is of course a very drastic contrast from say the 1930s, when California was actually the best place in the world to live. And if you had to sort of rewrite the Grapes of Wrath, you probably would have people taking a car and driving, or maybe a train, and going from California to Oklahoma, which again suggests that somehow things have gone a bit in reverse. And so I think we have this very strange question about all these things. The simplest way I have of describing this deceleration is in economic terms. And I'll just give you the one number is, if you look at 40-year periods, 1932 to 1972, that 40-year period, we saw average incomes in the United States go up by 350% after inflation. So you were making 4.5 times as much in 72 as you were in 32. And this was comparable to the progress that had happened in the 40 years before that, and so on going back in time. 1972, to 2012, it's gone up by 22%. That's including all the rich people they always complain about, by the way. If you exclude them, it's about flat. And so up 350% versus up 22%. And I think you sort of get the sense of why there have been decades of stagnation, and why even though our experts constantly tell us these breathtaking stories of technological progress and how we're in a cornucopian age and everything is fantastic, and just write them another check, another $1 million, and we'll cure cancer. It's always sort of, they're always a little bit too interested or not too objective about it. If you took a survey of people and asked how many people think the next generation will be better off than the current generation, at this point, it's probably something on the order of 75 to 80% of people in the US think the next generation will be less well off than the current generation. I believe the high point in the 70s on that was 50%, which was the amount Carter cited in his malaise speech in 1979. The first week, people thought it was a good speech. After that, people thought it was just too depressing. Things couldn't possibly be that bad. But we're actually at a point that's far worse than the malaise Carter described in 79 today. And I think that when you have this sort of lack of technological progress, and people are still expecting a lot of it to happen, there are sort of a lot of very strange phenomena that we've had the last few decades that I think make a lot more sense. I think that all these very strange bubbles we've had, of which there's been an extraordinary proliferation, the NASDAQ bubble in the 90s, the housing and finance bubble in the 2000s. I believe we now have a government bubble that's maybe halfway through and still going. It probably will be expanded dramatically with all the fake panic over the fiscal cliff at year end. And we've had, I don't think there's ever been a time in the history of the world when you had this many bubbles this fast in succession. I think there were only two in the entire history of the modern world that compared to the three or four that we've had the last 25 years. There was the one in the 20s, and there was one in the 1720s. My assumption after the 90s was that I would never see something like this again in my lifetime. People, you couldn't possibly start another bubble because people would have to die. It would take at least 60 years for people to forget about what had happened in the 90s, and we got one within 4 or 5 years. And I think it's happened because people are still expecting extraordinary progress, and therefore they believe that there's some kind of a story that will fund it, and they will invest in it. We're probably at this point, you can no longer actually convince people of the story of progress, and that's why the last bubble is probably this government-fueled one, since no one in the private sector will be fooled by something like this anymore. Now, I think that one of the questions that one always asks in these contexts, I'm often asked, is why has this happened? Why has there been such a strange deceleration? I think these why questions are always much harder to address than the what, the fact that something has gone very wrong. But I'll sort of throw out a few different hypotheses, and I do think a lot of it has to do with an extraordinary amount of mischief that's happened on the legislative left-wing legal side. The first one, I think, that people have dramatically underestimated is the role of environmentalism. Because if you sort of date the slowdown to the early 1970s, this was also the time at which started to become much more heavily regulated. And I think sort of the first approximation, what's happened is that we live in a world in which the world of stuff is heavily regulated, the world of bits or information is unregulated. And so Bill Gates, when he started Microsoft, was not subject to extensive government regulation, at least not in the 70s. There were some that happened in the late 90s. But in the 70s, not so much. But if you wanted to start build a nuclear power plant, or if you wanted to build a supersonic airplane, all these kinds of things became more and more heavily regulated. And so the two things that happened in the world of bits were basically computers and finance. We're now in the process of outlawing finance, so probably computers will be the only thing left going forward. But I think all these other things were more or less outlawed. And I think if people always get it backwards when they say, you know, why did all the rocket scientists go to work on Wall Street, and wasn't it a shame that Wall Street paid people so much and overpaid all these rocket scientists? You have to also ask the other side, which is why were they not allowed to build rockets anymore? And I think that's sort of a part of it. And so while I think that we probably had somewhat too many resources into finance and computers, it was a logical thing that happened because everything else was outlawed. The analogy I give was that it's like a chess in the Soviet Union, where it produced a fantastic number of great chess players. And it was because if you were a smart person and didn't want to sell out to the Communist Party in one form or another, you could go maybe into abstract number theory, you could go into chess, there were a few other things like that. And so you had a tremendous proliferation of chess. It's not that there's anything wrong with chess, but it is probably a little bit of a distortion of a society where you're allowed to play chess and not do anything else. We're not quite as bad as the Soviet Union, but that's sort of the distortion that I think we've seen in our society in recent decades. And I think people have really not come to terms with the full costs of this distortion. I think there's a broadening the environmental piece. I think there's been a shift towards a very risk-averse society where people think risk is dangerous, it should not be allowed. This is sort of the explosion of tort law and of all kinds of other conventions around why people should not take risk. And one could say sort of a lot more about that. And then I think the other part of it that I suspect has played an enormous role is this problem of political correctness, and especially in the sciences and the universities. We always tend to focus on the politicization of the academy on the humanities. We underestimate how bad it is on the sciences and how hard it is for people with heterodox views to get a hearing. And you know, we sort of have a few issues where you sort of get a sense that things are a little bit distorted. So if you were to question, say, climate change or stem cell research, or say nothing of Darwin's theory of evolution, that wouldn't work. But I think there's a degree to which the entire academic process has been politicized, and in a peer-reviewed system where your funding comes from what other people think, truth ends up being what a majority thinks, and all of our scientists are basically politicians in disguise. The thesis I have is that we have about 100 times as many people with PhDs working in science as we did in the 1920s. They're producing, in aggregate, less than they were in the 1920s. So the productivities per scientist is probably less than 1% of what it was in the 1920s. And I think, to first approximation, it's because they're not scientists at all. They're just politicians pretending to be scientists and good at getting grants from the government. And if you were to, you know, one way to frame this is that by politicizing science, we've essentially, you know, scientists and a politician are two very different things. It's like in Platonic philosophy, where a philosopher can never be a king, because to be a king requires a skill set very different from the skill set of a philosopher. And just like a philosopher king is a bit of a contradiction in terms, so also a scientist politician is a bit of a contradiction. I think a true scientist is very eclectic, somewhat eccentric, has ideas that nobody else thinks make any sense. That's how you discover new things. You come up with ideas that everybody thinks are crazy or are wrong. A politician is someone who is good at taking polls and figuring out what 51% of the people think is true. And that's why you don't have scientist politicians, and why the sort of peer review process, which ends up being very politically correct in science, has, I think, led to this this world where so little is being produced on the science side. You know, one could sort of go on and on about this, but I think one of the questions that's really worth asking is how can we sort of, you know, how do we how do we get back out from this? Probably you have to probably start by changing some of these rules. There's always a question people ask me in this context, whether there's a role for government in funding science and innovation. My first approximation is that there's probably less of a role today than ever before, because we're no longer living in a scientific and technological age, and the people in our government are not scientists or technologists. They don't understand anything about this. I looked at this the other day. There are about 535 people in the House and Senate. On a generous count, maybe 35 of them have some sort of background in science or engineering. The rest of them don't really understand that windmills don't work when the wind is not blowing, or that solar panels solar panels do not work at night. And so we end up with this world that's singularly incapable of it. And I think sort of a lot of the debates we have around policy are really symptomatic of this incredible illiteracy. The example I always give is the crazy debate around Solyndra and what went wrong with Solyndra. And there was sort of a Republican critique, which was that there had been process violations, and that you basically had there were kickbacks, and it had gone to people who donated to the Obama administration. They got funded. They got funded with this. And then the Obama administration's defense was also the sort of procedural defense. It was sort of a financial portfolio theory. We're investing in hundreds of companies, and some will work and some won't. Even though we have a well-diversified portfolio, we don't really know what's in it. And neither side was actually willing to talk about the science. And so Obama was not willing to say, here's one or two companies that are absolutely working and that I have tremendous confidence in. To actually think about the science or the technology is way too hard. And I think on the Republican side, nobody was willing to point out that a cylindrically shaped solar panel has a 2 pi r circumference versus 2 r, which would be a flat one, and therefore has an efficiency that's 1 over pi of a flat solar panel. It would absolutely never work. And this would basically require high school geometry to understand this. But that's already just way too scary for people to contemplate. We are certainly a world removed from the government-funded science version of, say, the New York Times on the day after Hiroshima in 1945. And I'm sort of paraphrasing, where, you know, all those who say that the government cannot push science have a lot of explaining to do. The government, you know, the army was able to get scientists, prima donna scientists, to provide a new invention to the world, the atom bomb, which these prima donna scientists might have taken half a century to come up with had they been left to their own. The New York Times does not write editorials like that anymore. And so I think there is actually, the libertarian view on this is, in from my perspective, is actually more true today than it was 40 or 50 years ago, because when you have a scientifically illiterate government that does not even understand this as a problem, you're not going to be able to have that be part of the solution. I think one of the other very strange places where this this plays a tremendous role, and this is so I think, you know, there sort of are all these legal areas. Let me say something about sort of constitutional law or some of the sort of more fundamental parts where I think it also intersects in some very very interesting ways. The current sort of economic crisis is always analyzed as a repeat from the 1930s of some sort. And we need to learn these lessons from the 30s, and we're very focused on avoiding the mistakes of the 30s. Bernanke studied the 30s. He's obsessed with not repeating it. And of course, he's focused on just, you know, sort of printing the right amount of money to basically get things going again. And what is very striking, however, is that in the 1930s, nobody believed that the financial economy was decoupled from the real economy. People at the time thought you couldn't just print money and that this wouldn't actually correspond to a way of solving problems. They thought that would lead to inflation, it wouldn't work. And the idea that you can simply print money without asking questions about whether how to spend the money or whether it's legal to spend it on anything productive is strangely absent. And you've had this sort of extraordinary decoupling of the financial economy from the real economy. I think it was heavily driven by Keynesianism, which sort of set the idea that the economy somehow is more than the sum of its parts. There's this thing called macroeconomics, and it's these animal spirits. It's all psychological. It's a state of mind. It's not about real things. And whereas the old-fashioned view of the economy to which I subscribe is that the economy, to first approximation, is the sum of its parts, and that you should focus on the real things and not the psychological things. And psychology is at best very secondary. But we're in a world where it's all focused on psychology, on processes, not on the underlying substance. The analogy I've given is that it's like if you're suffering from cancer, do you do chemo or do you do yoga? And there's the reductionist chemo and there's the psychological yoga, and you probably should do both. But if you have an economy where we're doing nothing but yoga, and we're doing 3 hours of yoga a day, and we've forgotten about chemo, and the only answer is we should ever do more and more yoga, there's perhaps something a little bit wrong with that. And that's the sort of perspective that one has today when one thinks about these things. The sort of decoupling of the real and the financial economy, if I had to sort of give a single Supreme Court case or set of cases that drove this, and this is my candidate for the most important Supreme Court cases that people no longer talk about or even remember. And they were so important and they changed the country in such a fundamental way that we no longer even remember the country that existed before them. There are a set of cases in the mid-30s around the gold clause and the gold standard, which basically you had every single contract in the US had a gold clause in it, and you could basically get paid in dollars or you could get paid in gold. So even though the US was on a gold standard of $20.67 per ounce, it was contractually enforced, and every single contract had this clause in it where you could get paid in paper money, but you could always choose as a creditor to be paid in gold instead. What the advantage of this gold standard had was that somehow money was linked to something real, and it was, you had this idea that money was always hard or fake. When the Supreme Court got rid of the gold clause, I think we forget how critical a role that actually played in the Depression. We now remember the Depression as this psychological event. It's like a mental depression. We remember things like FDR, where he said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And we remember it's this general Keynesian fear. The animal spirits were defeated. It was this general fear. I believe that's a complete misreading of the history. I think there was actually a very specific fear. The specific fear was that there was not enough gold, and that the banks didn't have enough gold, that the Fed had screwed things up in the 20s, it had printed too much money, and there was not enough gold, and that this was the one specific fear that drove everything. And we don't remember that part of the history. And instead, we remember this history where it's all about this decoupled financial world, decoupled from a real technological and scientific world. Now, I think the conservatives and libertarians who were against FDR and against the gold clauses seemingly were proved wrong in the 30s and 40s. There was this printing of money. Somehow, it actually worked. There wasn't that much inflation. It was like money grew on trees. And money does grow on trees in a technologically accelerating civilization, which we were still in the 1930s and 40s. You had incredible amounts of innovation in the 30s and 40s. You had the development of the aerospace industry, of the movie industry. You had the creation of the secondary oil recovery industry, the plastics industries. And in that sort of a world, you could actually get away with printing money. And I think we're ironically today in a world where we forgot the link between money and the real economy. We forgot the need for technological innovation. And even the people who are conservatives tend to think that that tinkering with money is somehow the real issue, when it's not actually, when actually the real issue is what people are actually doing and whether things are actually progressing. I feel I should end on a somewhat more apocalyptic note, since crisis of the Republican Party, or the crisis of conservatism, which I think came to sharp relief with this recent election. We're speaking of the crisis of America, the crisis of the West. I think it is somehow is a crisis of exceptionalism, and it's a question: are we still as exceptional as we once were? And I think one of the great challenges is that, to first cut, there is some truth to the Obama view that we are not that exceptional anymore. But it does not work if you leave it at that, and we have to figure out a way to go back to exceptionalism. And I think one of the bigger constitutional law questions that I think would be worth exploring in great deal is this link between accelerating technology and a constitutional Republican government with constitutional checks and balances. And I wonder whether such a form of government is even possible in a society without technological progress. The way I think our system works is that you have the elected representatives of the people, they gather around a table, and you're able to cut some sort of deal where you craft legislation, and the legislation makes everybody better off, or it makes most people better off, and everybody has an incentive to participate in the deal, because if you don't, you won't be worse off, but you just won't be better off. And so that's how our very complicated system of checks and balances works, and that's why things actually get done. In a world without growth, there are no positive sum things to do. Everything is zero sum. You will only win if you take something from somebody else. And everything becomes extremely acrimonious, extremely zero sum. The people who succeed in getting things are perceived to be involved in some sort of racket, and in many cases, they are in fact involved in some sort of racket. And you end up with this increasing distrust of institutions. And I think it is at least a curious coincidence that the sort of Republican, Democratic, constitutional form of government that we have only existed in this period of accelerating technological change. The one decade where it was put under great stress was the 1930s, and that's the decade where it broke in many different countries. It could not survive in a world of no growth. It came under considerable stress in the 70s. We were able to get a series of bubbles started in the last 20, 25 years. But I think we're now sort of confronting a world in which there is very little growth because there's very little progress. And it's very unclear how our political system will be able to craft compromises in this world. And this is why the sort of dysfunctional, polarized politics are not just a problem in the US. They are a problem in all Western nations. We're seeing the same experiment being run all over Southern Europe. Are you able to craft compromises that everyone can agree to when everyone loses or when there are no net winners? And it turns out to be extremely hard to do. And so I think that if you sort of get rid of exceptionalism as the framework and get rid of this idea of accelerating progress, there are all kinds of things that I suspect will begin to break down. The way we order our society is that people aspire to do to achieve more than their parents or more than the previous generation. That motivates us to try hard. It's one of the things that gives a sense of direction and purpose to the way our societies are organized. And this becomes much harder to do in a stagnant world. I think the basic approach you do is, if you don't think things can get better, you try less hard. You start talking about a work-life balance. That's normally what people start talking about when they don't want to work anymore. And um, and you know, eventually sort of everything kind of goes to pot in California, somewhat literally. And so I do think we need to find a way back. I'm always hopeful that there is something indomitable about the human spirit, that even though there are these many problematic trends, there are some ways to rethink things. We are at a point of considerable crisis. There's a hope that this crisis will be an opportunity to rethink things and try to somehow get back to the future. But I think sort of in many ways, the first step is to understand where we are. To mix and mangle a few metaphors, it is like it's like Nero fiddling while Rome is burning, but unlike Nero, we do not know that we are fiddling, and we do not know that that things are burning. Or an alternate metaphor, that we've been spending 40 years wandering in the desert, and we think that it's an enchanted forest. We need to, if we're going to find our way out of this desert and back to the future, I think the first step is to see that we have been in a desert and to find a way out. Thank you very much.